high and the mighty will fall. There will be no power brokers, the wall of power will fall.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Wall of Power Radio Hour. This is your host, Paul Metza, celebrating 10 years on the air this spring on AM 950. This weekend, we are reminded of the yin and yang of history, American history, as 54 years ago today, four unarmed students were gunned down by the National Guard at Kent State. And on a lighter note, one of America's greatest folk singers, Pete Seeger, would have turned 105 on May 3rd, but he's celebrating in heaven with Woody Guthrie, where Woody is the bartender. Here to make sense of it, if not all, at least part of it, is one of Wall of Power's Radio Hour's favorite guests in a reoccurring episode we've referred to as Checkpoint Charlie. Mr. Charles Pierce writes a political blog for Esquire.com. He's a sports nut, author, Twitter ex-madman, and a Wisconsin beer scholar, and former roommate of banjo picker Gary Popovich. And while listening to Gary practice banjo, discovered several different types of Wisconsin beer. He's appeared on CNN, MSNBC, and on this station with great regularity on the Stephanie Miller Show. From his home in Massachusetts, we are excited to welcome Checkpoint Charlie Pierce. Charlie, how are you today?
Man, that was a formal radio introduction right there.
Well, I kind of wing it with you because it's so free and easy. But for those people that are just chiming in to AM 950 that might not have heard my show or you, I thought I'd give them a little description. And I think I did a hell of a good job myself.
You did. You even sort of had the famous NPR voice, you know, the NPR voice, where we describe a massive volcanic eruption taking out half the United States with the same voice we use to talk about a bill passing through the House of Representatives.
Hey, speaking of bills and D.C. and all the rest, you were courtside not too long ago at the Supreme Court. Is that correct? You're actually in the chamber?
Two of the most disheartening days of my political writing life. Watching first the oral argument on the Idaho reproductive rights argument, our case, and then the presidential immunity case the next day, both of which have me despairing of common sense asserting itself anytime soon.
What was it like seeing the folks in black robes in action?
Well, there's a, you know, this is not much. I mean, I've been to several oral arguments. First of all, you don't get very good seats. There are a great number of press seats in the chamber that qualify as what we call at Fenway Park obstructed view seats. So you have to kind of like look around a pillar to see what's going on. And you have to develop an ability to define or identify the various justices by their voice. And I'm still kind of behind on that because I can't really pick out Kavanaugh and Gorsuch. I get those two confused all the time. The women are fairly easy to distinguish, largely because Justice Sonia Sotomayor has a, you know, Spanish-flavored accent. And Amy Coney Barrett's got a Midwestern twang, and Elena Kagan's from the East Coast. So those three are easy. It's the indistinguishable conservatives that are a problem in so many ways, I might add.
Now, wasn't if I'm remembering correctly, with the immunity case, the lawyer arguing for Donald Trump, was it just me, or does he have a more annoying voice than RFK Jr.?
Yeah, he's got that whole Trump thing going on. That's John Sauer, the Assistant Solicitor General from Louisiana. He's got that raspy thing going on, but it's mostly what he was saying that was crazy, not the way he found it.
So, how many people are in the chamber listening to that live, Charlie?
You know, I don't know what the capacity is. It's pretty big, and then of course there's a there's a section walled off, kind of off to the side for where the media sits, and then there's the open gallery in front of the judges, and I'm not going to Google it. I can't Google it while we're on the air, but. I would say there's, a couple of hundred easily.
Huh.
People, and it's first come, first serve for the public gallery. So on big cases, you have people like sleeping out on the sidewalk the night before to be in line.
Wow. I would imagine there's a pretty heavy security presence to get in.
It's about the same as every other government building now. I mean, it's metal. You pass through a metal detector to get in the building. You pass through another metal detector to get into the chamber. Obviously, you're not allowed to bring cell phone or recording device of any kind into the chamber, which is kind of odd because you could stay at home, listen to it online, and record it there. But it's garrisoned just about the same as any other government building is these days.
Well, let's start. So you're there for 2 days. Let's start with the Idaho case. When did your brain start to explode during those arguments?
Well, that is, transcripts are available if you're so inclined at the Supreme Court website. That had to be the grisliest oral argument in the history of the Supreme Court, because the people arguing against the Idaho law had to explain all the complications for pregnancy that would no longer be covered under the new statute, including the fact that there are now airlifting women whose pregnancies are in extremis. They're now airlifting them to other states.
Wow.
There was all kinds of, case studies of women just having horrible, horrible results from their pregnancies, and all of these incredibly touching stories being sort of thrown down a well and buried in a bunch of procedural and legal stuff that doesn't have any blood or any humanity to it.
Right. So then let's go your next day with the immunity case. That's terrifying.
Yeah, you talk about as the upcoming birthday boy from Hibbing put it, you talk about the cards all being marked in advance.
Yeah.
That one was incredibly predictable. They will not, my guess, and I don't think I'm the first person to say this, my guess is that they're not going to give him the full immunity that he wants. Even Barrett and Kavanaugh seem doubtful about that. But what they will do is they'll carve out some procedure to differentiate between official acts and private acts, make Jack Smith and his prosecutors jump through that hoop, which will jump through those new hoops, which will pretty much make having a decision in court in that case over by the election impossible. And I think that's been the whole purpose of this exercise in the first place. The Supreme Court never should have taken that case. The appeals court wrote a completely bulletproof opinion denying the whole idea of sovereign of presidential immunity as a legal fiction drawn up on the spot by some desperate lawyers. And yet the Supreme Court took the case anyway, which was pretty much the first indication that the real purpose of this whole exercise was to delay the trial until it couldn't have any effect on the election.
Does it blow your mind that the majority of the Supreme Court justices are still in the tank for Trump? I mean, can't they hide
it? It bothers the living daylights out of me. I mean, this particular case, it was so obvious that they might as well have put it up in pink neon. I mean, none of the prime conservative justices, Robert Thomas, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, none of those people wanted to argue the facts of the case in front of them. They all wanted to argue what might happen if they ruled for Jack Smith, and wouldn't that put future presidents in danger? And wouldn't this leave the door open for all these imaginary horrors? But they didn't want to argue what was in front of them.
Right.
It was appalling. It was like watching professional wrestling, by people who weren't real good at professional wrestling.
Well, didn't Gorsuch say, we've got to make the make this decision for the ages? I mean,
Yeah, that was the one that knocked me out of my chair. But the other thing is, you had Brett Kavanaugh, of all people, arguing against runaway special prosecutors, the guy who cut his teeth under Kenneth Starr,
right,
in the great penis case of 1998, and you had Sam Alito talking about unintended consequences, where the day before he wasn't willing to engage on the unintended consequences of the overruling of Roe v. Wade that he authored.
Right. So, on a personal note, when you spend
I took a slow walk down Capitol Hill to the Dubliner and sat there until the feeling passed.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you next. Have you ever been to the, I was out there, I think, in 99 at a conference, and I went to a little watering hole called the Monocle, which is right off.
Yeah, that's about halfway down the hill.
Oh, man. Have you ever been there?
I have. Yeah, that's the one with all the people, famous people, pictures of the famous people who used to drink there on the wall.
Including John Tower.
Yes, who was there a lot, apparently.
I loved it because, I mean, people, JFK used to drink there. And I think at some point they wanted to, demolish it for probably a parking lot or a high rise. And there was an act of Congress to save the Monocle. The night I was there, Charlie Pierce, Kay Bailey Hutchinson cut in front of the men's line to go to the restroom because the women's line was so long. I was happy to let her in and guard the door for her. And Henry Hyde was having dinner. It was just, amazing for anybody that's kind of interested in politics to see where the sausages gets made. And I was talking to the bartender, who looked like Robert E. Lee, very soft-spoken guy, made one of the best martinis I ever had. And I looked at him and I said, "You know where all the bodies are buried, don't you?" And he just smiled. And I think, well, he was pouring my third martini. I do have to admit, I kiped a martini shaker from the Monocle that I'm going to save when you and Popovich come to Duluth. And we'll start off the evening at my place with shaken martinis, not stirred, from that very martini shaker. We've got Charlie Pierce on for the whole show tonight in honor of what would have been Pete Seeger's 105th birthday. We're going to play a little number that Pete Potrise called If I Had a Hammer and be back with Mr. Pierce for the whole show.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning. I'd hammer in the evening, all over this land. I'd hammer out danger, I'd hammer out a warning. I'd hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land. If I had a bell, I'd ring it in the morning. I'd ring it in the evening, all over this land. I'd ring out danger, I'd ring out a warning. I'd ring out love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land. If I had a song, if I had a song, I'd sing it in the morning. I'd sing it in the evening, all over this land. I'd sing out danger, I'd sing out a warning, I'd sing out a love.
Welcome back to the second set of the Wall of Power Radio Hour. This is your host, Paul Metza. Our guest, we're always delighted to have him in episodes we call Checkpoint Charlie, is Mr. Charlie Pierce. Charlie, you cut off a little bit at the end of that set, but we played a Pete Seeger's If I Had a Hammer. I don't know if I told you the story. Have you, bumped into or heard New England folk singer Dar Williams at some point, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Dar's like the American Billy Bragg.
Yeah, right. She's phenomenal. And a couple
very
years
political.
Ago,
in fact, I just watched a video the other day. I guess it was some sort of celebration where she and Billy Bragg and a bunch of other people sang Union Maid.
Oh, nice. Well, I have the honor and bragging rights. I opened up Billy Bragg's first Minneapolis show in 1984 at 7th Street Entry, which is the little sister club behind First Avenue. And he and I have kind of been buddies ever since. The last time I saw him, he was in Minneapolis a few years ago. He put out a book, really highly recommended, about the history of skiffle music. And he's still out there doing it. He, I believe, I don't have it, put out, they recently released a compendium of his music, like 350-some songs, and Billy is still out there fighting a good fight. But Dar Williams told me she was coming to Minneapolis, and I interviewed her, and she lives in the Hudson Valley, right up the road from Pete Seeger. She told me a great story. She said she was literally in a hardware store on a Saturday, and she saw Pete Seeger buying a hammer. I don't know if
tell
you call that.
Tell me a song about it.
Oh, I don't know if you call that irony or just a kismet, but it's a great story, and God bless him.
That is absolutely hilarious.
So,
Pete made a lot of friends in the Hudson Valley with all the work he did with the river.
Oh yeah. Well, he basically got that. I mean, it's significantly cleaned up since he started with the Clearwater and Arlo Guthrie, getting the Hudson cleaned up. Just
and cleaning up the Hudson was also Bobby Kennedy Jr.'s big project.
Yeah,
before he went completely off the rails.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which is a shame. You know, I had the pleasure of when I played at the invited by Nora Guthrie to play the tribute to Woody Guthrie in 96 in Cleveland. Part of it was at Case Western University, and then part was at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in a little club called the Odeon, two nights of music. But I got there early on Sunday. That was the big show. That was Pete, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Arlo Guthrie, the Indigo Girls, Ani DiFranco, Bruce Springsteen, a cast of thousands, Joe Wheely, Jimmy LaFave. And I had gotten there early, and I went into the dressing room, and I was like the second guy there. The first guy there was Pete Seeger, and we walked in, and it was about, I think the show was later in the afternoon. It was about maybe noon or one. Pete was doing sit-ups.
Really?
Yeah. Incredible. And I didn't want to interrupt his workout, but, you know, he played until he was 95. We're gonna talk a little bit about the Rolling Stones in the last set, because I just saw some clips from the New Orleans Jazz Fest, and Mick Jagger's looking pretty good at 80 years old.
Yeah, he's the guy who said years ago that he didn't want to be doing rock and roll when he was 50.
Well, money talks, BS walks, right? Hey, we got
well, the problem is they started making really good music again.
Yeah,
they can't stop themselves.
Yeah, no, I'm all for it. You know, the one thing I love about you, Charlie Pierce, is, you know, I refer to you as my psychological morphine drip for all things political. And I got hip to your writing when I was reading something, and you referred to Wisconsin boy Paul Ryan as the zombie-eyed granny starver. And you're just great giving names to people and things going on. And I want to get back, because there's so many cases going on with Donald Trump, none of us can follow it, but let's get back to where what you refer to as the pool shed papers are.
Yeah, that's, of course, in the hands of Judge Cannon, and, you know, conflicted to an extent. Judge Cannon is, you know, she's a rookie and miles over her head, and makes up for that by being conflicted, you know, to the nth degree. And she's slow playing that baby for all it's worth.
Well, and then Trump came out with one of his Truth Social posts, blessing her for her complicity and saying she'd make a great Supreme Court justice.
Oh, God, no. I mean, I have no doubt he thought about it. I mean, you know, I don't know, you know, I mean, given what he did to the Supreme Court last time, you know, he's liable to put, you know, I mean, Stormy Daniels may have blown her chance to be on the Supreme Court by suing him, you know? Who knows who will put on there?
You know, weirdly, in my head, I put partial blame on Obama for the mic drop at the correspondence dinner in 2016, when I think Trump got so PO'd that thought, yeah, maybe I will run for president, although I don't think it was his idea. But you had recently written about the correspondence dinner that took place a couple weeks ago. Tell us about that. I think, what did you refer to it as the, well, tell us about, yeah, you were at the course, you were following the course.
No, I wasn't. No. You will never see me at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
What did you refer, you referred to it as the D.C.'s Burning Man, though.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Or Coachella, I forget which.
Yeah, so, you had a great piece in your blog, your political blog on Esquire. Tell us a little bit about why you think that should be deep sixed.
Well, I mean, it's embarrassing to my profession. I mean, you have all these people pretending they're going to the Oscars and, you know, congratulating themselves on, you know, being at the peak of their profession, as though covering the White House isn't one of the most deadening beats in the history of the world. And, you know, bringing, you know, movie stars and celebrities of varying magnitudes to be your guests. And it's just, ooh, it's awful. It's awful. Give me a pitcher of beer at the Tune In rather than go to that.
So,
and you know why I have a pitcher of beer at the Tune In? Because they carry Lining Kugel's lager.
Nice.
Not the fancy Lining Kugel's. Not the Shandy or the Red or the Christmas Bach and all the other ones that they market all. Just a straight Lining Kugel's lager. which is my favorite, you know, basic American beer.
I'm a huge Lineys fan. In fact, back in when I moved to Minneapolis in 78, they carried it at the 400 Bar, which is a wonderful corner bar where musicians like Willie Murphy and Spider John Kerner and Tony Glover and Dave Ray, my band Cats and the Stars, held forth for years. And they carried Liney. And back then, to show you how the beer scene has evolved in Minnesota and elsewhere, we considered Liney and Kugel's kind of a special imported beer because we got it from Wisconsin.
It's like we when I was in college, we used to drink Heilemann Special Export.
Oh, yeah.
I always wondered where they exported it to, Chicago.
Special X, God, that stuff was deadly. But, you know, I was also a big fan. I saw it about 6 months ago. I picked up a six-pack of Point beer. And
Point was a really good one. That was Point was hard to get in Milwaukee. I suspect because, you know, there was some distributor finagling going on because of, you know, the big breweries in Milwaukee. But, yeah, I'm very big on Point. And, of course, we're omitting the contributions of Minnesota, Grain Belt and Hams.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. PBR. And, we're big. Big fan of all those beers, but I actually played a gig in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, where Point Beer came out of, and I give them major credit for their slogan, "When you're out of Point, you're out of town." So,
that's got to be a play on the old Schlitz slogan, right? When you're out of Schlitz, you're out of beer?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that's a nice shout out to their rival. There is Duluth is got a handful of great new breweries. I'm a big fan of. There's a company that my buddy started called Flat Earth Beer, and they've got this stuff called Caribou Lake, which is I love a hoppy beer and. It's like got just the right amount of hops for me. You know, I'm not a very sophisticated drinker. I like Tito's Martinis. And when I go into a liquor store and I want to get a bottle, if I got friends coming over to drink wine, they go, "And what sort of wine are you looking for?" And I go, "Red and under $10. But I do like
cork
my
beer. Cork or screw top.
What's that?
Cork or screw top.
Yeah. Charlie, I got to ask you personally. So, if you have something a little harder with your Lineys or your Sam Adams, what are you, a bourbon guy?
No, John Jameson's Irish whiskey.
Oh, there you. What am I thinking?
I am faithful unto death. I like bourbon. Bourbon. I can't abide scotch. I just never developed taste for it. But secondarily to Jameson or anything except Bushmills, because as my grandmother used to say, Bushmills was strained through the wrong Bible. I like bourbon. My friend, the writer Wright Thompson down in Mississippi, keeps trying to convert me to bourbon. But he drinks like Pappy Van Winkle, which is, you know, you have to take out federal matching funds to buy a bottle. So.
Of course, it's always...
Mr. Beam and I are old companions.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Our buddy Jim Beam, know him well. Say, real quickly, we got a couple of minutes left. Let's talk about the puppy killer, governor of South Dakota.
Christina. Oh, she's in big trouble now. I mean, not only is she a puppy, and please let's not forget the goat. She killed the goat too. Nobody cares for the goat, but it's been discovered. And it's only in political, and it's only been on Politico for about the last 40 minutes on Friday when we're taping this. There's all kinds of other bullpucky in her book, including her saying that she met Kim Jong-un, which which is such an egregious lie, that her spokesman has already copped to it, saying the publisher's going to take care of it. I think that book is headed to the gravel pit myself.
Oh, my God. And then, you know, to top it all off, and then her kids show up in the school bus right after she's got rid of the dog and the goat. I mean, that's the whole thing.
Yeah, her little daughter says, where's Cricket?
Oh,
and
my.
Not only is that a gross indecency, but she puts it in the book. She puts her daughter, her child, you know, I don't know, daughter's like 8 or 9, I guess, at that point. You know, she puts that child's anguish in her book.
Oh, I know. It's cruel.
This, by the way, is the woman who's banned from almost every Native American reservation in South Dakota.
Yeah, rightfully so. Well, we're going to end this segment with Checkpoint Charlie Pierce with a little Tomty Hall song. We're going to send out to the spirit of Cricket, Old Dogs, Children, and Watermelon Wine. Be back.
Oh, that is such a great song. That was the song that I heard for the first time that won me over to Tomty Hall.
Cool. Let's listen to it and have Charlie on for one more set.
How old do you think I am, he said. I said, well, I didn't know. He said, I turned 65 about 11 months ago. I was sitting in Miami pouring blended whiskey down when this old gray black gentleman was cleaning up the lounge. There wasn't anyone around except this old man and me. The guy who ran the bar was watching Ironsides on TV. Uninvited, he sat down and opened up his mind on old dogs and children and watermelon wine. Ever had a drink of watermelon wine, he asked. He told me all about it, though I didn't answer back. Ain't but three things in this world that's worth a solitary dime, but old dogs and children and watermelon wine.
Welcome back to the third set of the Wall of Power Radio Hour. This is your host, Paul Metz, my guest for the whole show tonight, Checkpoint Charlie Pierce. Of course, that was Ohio by Crosby, Stills, and Nash. As it is 54 years to the day today that those four unarmed students were shot by the National Guard at Kent State. Charlie, you must have been in college right at that time.
No, I... In May of 1970, I was a junior in high school.
Oh, okay. But you remember it.
It's not like it didn't affect me. I mean, it was, you know, a real bolt from the blue. And what really affected me was the reaction of so many people that they had gotten what they deserved.
Yeah.
That really pushed me over the line into some real alienation from practically everything, and probably kickstarted my interest in politics. I wasn't political very much at all in high school, but that got me reading stuff. And of course, followed up like a couple of weeks later by the two kids killed at Jackson State in Mississippi, which nobody remembers.
Yeah, tell us about that. You wrote about it recently.
Yeah, that was the local police in Jackson had been harassing the students at Jackson State, which is a historically black university, and some of the students, I guess, swung back, and they were kind of, you know, pushed back onto the campus, and the police opened fire and killed a couple of kids. And interestingly enough, given the fact that you played Neil Young's song there, the Beach Boys actually worked the Jackson State event into a song.
Really?
Yeah, and it was a remake of another song. But the lyric, as I recall, was something about Jackson State brothers learned not to say bad things about Southern troopers' mothers.
Wow. That's a little unknown fact. I wonder if Dr. Demento ever played that one.
I don't know. I've never heard it on the radio.
Wow. You know Dr. Demento's from Minneapolis.
I did not know that.
Yeah. He went to the U-High, which was a kind of a very liberal high school in the Dinkytown area, with a good friend of mine, Arnie Broger, and a fella by the name of Dave Snaker Ray went there as a high school student. Yeah, it was quite a, you know, that was Dinkytown. That's where Bob Dylan came out of,
Is that guy the Ray of Kerner, Ray, and Glover?
That would be Kerner, Ray, and Glover, who I was proud to say was a very good friend of mine. But,
I first learned about Tony Glover when he was writing record reviews for Rolling Stone.
He was a great writer.
I had no idea he was a musician until much later on. I thought he was a really good record reviewer.
Yeah, no, he was very astute. I was going through my archives, and I found he passed away about 3 or 4 years ago, and I found his memorial program. It was actually the last time Spider John Kerner played in public, and there was a great picture on the inside of, he was one of the early fans of Patti Smith. And wrote about her. And when Patty came to play the Guthrie Theater, there's a picture of Patty, and Tony was sitting cross-legged on the side of the stage, played with a harmonica with her. He also played with the Doors at the Guthrie Theater. But yeah, he had, you love this story, Charlie, he had a radio show for a couple of years on KDWB late at night on Sundays. And it was called like Late Night with Tony Glover or something. But he had been lifelong friends with Bob Dylan. In fact, Tony's widow sold his archives of ephemera and books and records and letters from Bob Dylan for almost $500,000 after Tony passed. But he had called Bob Dylan when he started the radio show, and he goes, yeah, I'm trying to figure out a title. And Bob Dylan suggested Tony Glover call it Crimson and Glover.
Oh, jeez, Bob. a dad joke from Bob.
Well, Bob's got that, if you ever listen to his theme time radio hour, he's got that Borscht Belt thing going on big time. So let's talk a little bit about the campus protests, because, you know, really we haven't seen this sort of nationwide protests on college campuses, of course, against Israel's relentless pounding of Gaza, and now the you know what's going. Now the University of Minnesota campus just settled with the people that were in camp, the students that were in camp there. But what's your whole take on it? In just this crazy response by the authorities.
Oh, that's the. Now it's spiraled so far away from the original purpose of the protest. It's almost, the original intent of the protest is all lost in the noise now. But there, the idea that you would turn our currently, and I advise everyone, I recommend everyone to the works of a guy named Corey Robin, who's been covering this trend for the trend of militarizing the police for over a decade now. And the idea that you would turn a militarized police force onto a bunch of people sleeping in tents on the lawn is just absurd to me. I mean, it absolutely beggars belief. And it's nice to see that certain schools, Brown and Northwestern, principal among them, are finding negotiated settlements for this thing. Probably based on the fact that you shouldn't get your head busted for sleeping in a tent.
Yeah, well then, you know, I've been watching it for years, and I mean, this reality never existed where, you know, Barney Fife and Andy walking down the street, and Andy wasn't carrying a gun, and Barney barely knew how to handle his, but they were both in uniform. And now you find all these police forces around the country getting these secondhand military gear from the Army and the Navy or wherever. It injects a certain amount of psychological steroids, I think, into all these people donning that gear as just police officers.
Oh, it absolutely does, and you know, couple that with the that policy that mercifully has ended of selling surplus military equipment to any police force that can cobble up the money to buy it. I mean, so you get police forces in towns of 800 people buying tanks.
Yeah,
you don't buy something like that unless you intend to use it.
Exactly.
You don't buy it for, you know, to use it as a kiddie ride on Memorial Day weekend or something. You buy it so you use it against somebody, and sooner or later you use it against somebody.
Well, yeah, it's sitting in their garages, and they're just chomping at the bit to use it against somebody.
Yeah, I mean, it's a problem that, you know, in a lot of ways it's a problem nobody wants to address. I remember 4 or 5 years ago, there was a lot of talk about criminal justice reform and police reform and prison reform were going to be the common ground for left and right to come together and improve the policies. And that whole golden dream died in about 11 minutes.
Yeah.
As soon as, you know, the events broke out in Ferguson, Missouri.
Oh, yeah.
And then we're back to let's just go kick ass again.
Charlie, we got just a little time left. As I always refer to you as my psychological morphine drip for all things political. And give me some good news here. I mean, we're just, you know, we're 200 plus days away from the election. I think anybody's insane that would want to vote for Donald Trump, but it looks like half the country is. What's the upside? What are the green shoots coming through the cement?
Well, I mean, the Democrats won another special election.
Yeah.
They've cut Speaker Mike Johnson's majority down to one vote now. The guy in New York won, a Democrat in New York won George Santos' seat. Which I hope he has disinfected before he sits in it. But in any event, I feel very good about the Congress in the fall.
Okay.
And I think, you know, that Biden is going to struggle through. I don't think you know, I think you could get a pretty good price on a bet that that the former president doesn't even make it to the election.
Yeah.
Either he's in jail, or he completely physically collapses, or he dies.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine, you know, what his metabolism, you know, must look like a landfill at this point.
Well, I'm going to take that as a good news. That you pumped up my psychological.
Well, you've got to be in a good mood, Paul. The spring is coming in the Northland.
Well, and next week fishing season opens, and
the walleyes are scared.
We get it right off our front dock on Lake Vermilion, one of the seven greatest freshwater lakes in the world, according to a man that wrote a book about such things. Well, you and Popovich, one of these days, you got to come up. We'll do a little fishing. We'll do a little beer drinking, and we'll do
Pop,
a little.
Pop's living in the mountains now.
He was what?
He's living in the mountains now.
Yeah, I heard that. Well, I hate to rock around the corner and see Popovich playing banjo on a porch. I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay.
Charlie Pierce, thank you so much, man. Have a beautiful weekend. A great
you
spring.
Too, my
we're
going
to be in touch every month here until
we are,
the election.
Going into the election, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you, Charlie Pierce. Read Charlie on politics in his blog. And once again, Charlie, what's your Twitter handle?
It's at Charles P. Pierce, and it's capital C, capital P, capital P. So.
All right. Charlie, thanks so much, man. Have a great weekend.
Hey, it's always a pleasure, Paul. Take care, man.
Okay, man. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to the Wall of Power Radio Hour. The show was produced by Paul Metza, engineered by Patrick Lilia. We'd like to thank our guest, Charles P. Pierce. We always enjoy having him on. We call the episodes Checkpoint Charlie. Hope everybody out there is enjoying the spring. Get a nice present for your mom, and don't forget to call her. Follow me at paulmetza.com. If you come up to Duluth every Wednesday, I'm at the Blackwater Lounge from 6 to 8. 231 East Superior Street. And like my dad used to tell me, remember to be kind and make someone happy.